Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The date today is February 26, 2025, and this is episode 504. You're listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. I am the co-host Mark Ames in Western New York. And I'm on the line with Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher in Puglia, Italy. How you doing, John?
I'm good. I've really done a lot of research on our topic today, and I hope I can unpack it properly, but I'm raring to go.
Yeah, this is really complicated, and we've wanted to do more on Congo wars, and especially as they're back in the news again for a while. And we definitely had a lot of subscribers saying, you know, it's time to do something on M23. And it's been, frankly, kind of hard to find somebody we thought would be good for our format to talk to. It's not, you know, the most widespread specialty, and it's not easy to find Congolese voices. So we're always open to, if anybody has suggestions, please send them our way as well. But John, you've been, you know, writing a lot about African wars and making sense of African wars. Going back to the beginning of the Warnerd column in the old exile days. And I think, you know, pretty much uniquely, I think, among American English language writers, you've made those wars understandable and interesting, comprehensible, I think, for, I don't know, our type of audience. So,
right.
You know,
well,
and I mean, definitely have. And I think that's why people wanted to hear, wanted to get your take on what's up with the latest M23 taking these cities in Eastern Congo and the larger context, I guess. And it's just, I mean, I've spent some time trying to, you know, educate myself on it. And it is complicated. It's complicated. And it's like, where do you start? How far back do you go?
Like, you know, some of the wars that I was dealing with in the past in Africa were relatively straightforward, like the war between Ethiopia and Eritrea, the war between the Ethiopian Derg and the various dissident groups fighting it. That was a pretty straightforward war. DR Congo and the lakes and Rwanda, it's a lot more complex.
Yeah. Real quickly before we go in, just a couple of like news item, ticker items, you know. Just this morning it was reported, so Kaya Kallas, who we talked about in the last episode, that, you know, we had been given what seemed like pretty reliable in, you know, in the know information on how one of the things that really set off the Trump people, Hegseth and Vance, last week and sort of tanked, you know, US-EU relations to a new level was Kaya Kallas, the former Estonian prime minister, NAFO cheerleader who became the EU's, basically the foreign minister. She had gotten into Hegseth's face and insulted him and thought that was the way to deal with the Trumpists, was by insulting them and calling them monsters and appeasers and Chamberlain and this kind of stuff. So just this morning, it's reported that Kaya Kallas, again, this is the, you know, one of the top three, probably most powerful people in the EU bureaucracy, basically the head of foreign affairs, flew to Washington to meet with her counterpart, Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, and Rubio canceled the meeting.
So she'd already flown there?
Yeah. And so she's apparently going to meet with some people from Congress instead. But this would seem to confirm what we were told last week.
It has the Trump admin signature on it. It's like, it's very loud, very rude, and kind of petty.
Yep.
Sorry. Did you fly across the continent and then the ocean? Just, oh, well.
Yeah. I don't know. And I guess in somewhat similar news, well, a couple other things. Yeah. Romania just arrested this kind of far right demagogue, or as they call populist, kind of a loon ball dork, Ciolan Georgescu, I think is how you pronounce his name. This guy who came in first in the presidential elections that were then canceled. And he was just arrested this morning. So it's another one of these instances. And they released photos. I swear to God, this looks just like Kremlin TV when they stomp on some opposition person that, you know, they want out of the scene. They released photos of what they said were was a stash of $10 million in cash buried under his house, plus tickets to Moscow, airline tickets. Wow. And that's just, I mean, when you're going to do a stitch up, you know, I don't know, maybe the crudity is the point, but like, there's got to be better stitch ups than that. You know?
Yeah.
And he had tickets to Moscow.
Like, yeah. I mean, if you were going to do a quick flight, I don't think you'd want to buy tickets long in advance unless you really underestimated the local intelligence service.
I doubt, you know, just as a personal reference, when I faced that crackdown on the exile and, you know, the Kremlin sent some Roskomnadzor officials to our editorial offices and charged me with editorial crimes for the exile. And I spoke to some lawyers, Russian lawyers, and a couple people I knew from like Yukos, who were old friends of mine. And they just said, look, just make sure you have a bag ready to and be ready to fly out. And whatever you do, don't buy your ticket in advance. Just go to the airport and buy your ticket in the airport and just do it that way. And I mean, it's obvious that's what you do. You don't have the ticket lying around.
Yes.
So anyway, so that happened. That's just like another one of these instances of the political establishment in all of these countries. I mean, Romania may be more brittle than others. Trying to shore up their faltering status quo by accelerating the collapse of people's faith in the status quo. Mm-hmm. I mean, by trashing your own institutions, by arresting the guy who won the elections and canceling the elections. Like, I mean, they're just accelerating, you know, whatever the hell's going on there in Romania. We should find somebody, you know, we should talk about Romania one of these days. Interesting.
So as far as you know, he won the election.
Oh, he did.
Fairly?
Yes. Well, what they said was there was no like falsification. The allegation was they were so shocked, the authorities were so shocked when he won that they didn't know what to say at first. And then they came out and said, the intelligence services said that he won because of a TikTok campaign that was run out of Moscow because of Russian disinformation.
They know that anything against TikTok will really resonate with the centrist American elite at the moment.
Well, and then what? When they dug deeper and people looked into what intelligence actually found, what they actually found was that it was the leading pro-EU liberal party that paid like a PR company, strategic communications company, to boost this guy's candidacy as a way of taking votes away from their pro-EU rivals, a more conservative party.
There's something medically wrong with these people.
I know.
It's like, well, let us see.
Yeah.
What did Bill Clinton do in the upshot of the Trump campaign?
Yeah.
Ah, perhaps that is the way we can be clever.
It's amazing. They just keep doing this to them. They're like subconscious accelerationists. It's really amazing.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of two little bits of world news. But let's get to this story, which is really, I mean, look, Congo had a world war there from the late 90s and the 2000s, like, and the bloodiest of post-World War II wars, as far as I know.
Yep.
And of course, Rwanda.
Not that many people noticed, but they had it. Yeah.
Yeah, Rwanda, of course, suffered the genocide. And so there's a lot going on there. And yeah, where do you want to start?
There's a lot. There's a lot of blood under the bridge.
Yeah.
As Delmar O'Donnell would say, Speaking of Romania, I have a story that touches on what's going on in the far eastern borderlands between the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda, and features a whole lot of Romanians. In fact, in this case, a whole lot of military-age Romanians who are photographed standing in line, unarmed, many of them having their hands up, because they are a group of 300 Romanian mercenaries recruited to fight for the Army of the Democratic Republic of Congo in Goma, which is the capital of northern Kivu province in the far east, up against the lakes, and across the lake from Rwanda. And they surrendered ignominiously when the M23 movement captured Goma a couple of weeks ago. And what this story does, I think, is highlight a lot of the interesting aspects of the whole DRC M23 controversy that have not really been stressed by most people. Like, why doesn't the Congolese army ever fight? Mm-hmm. How come all it does is flee? Why then do the M23 fighters fight and the Rwandan Tutsi in general fight? Very bravely. It doesn't seem to be a particularly regional problem. It's more something about the polities of those two places that determines what the conduct of their soldiers is going to be. Because the cowardice, and there's no other way to put it, of the Congolese army is legend. I mean, they not only deserted Goma before the M23 took it, they also looted Goma and took absolutely everything that they could get. The M23 soldiers were relatively disciplined, at least in the traditional sense that conquer first, then plunder. You know, it's like, you got to do this right. Once the commander announces, okay, we've got the town, as Churchill was supposed to have said during the U.S. Civil War, after taking a city, I closed my eyes for 3 hours. they looted, but they looted after they conquered the city. So why is it that, you know, the Congolese army, whoever is in it, whatever era it is, doesn't fight? Well, it's pretty simple, really. Here's a quote from the story. The BBC has seen contracts that show that these hired soldiers from Romania were being paid around $5,000 a month, while regular military recruits in Congo get around $100 or sometimes go unpaid.
Yeah.
So if you trust the foreigners from a country you probably don't even know much about, to the tune of $5,000 a month, which is a lot of money, even in the first world, well, to me anyway, and you pay your own soldiers $100 a month, or you pay them nothing, or they have to kick the whole thing back to their unit commanders, then it's not really that difficult to understand why they aren't going to risk death to fight for you, which raises the question that I think has to be asked before we delve into the details of this story. What the hell kind of way is that to run an army? And it does make sense, but it makes a kind of horrible sense, which is you don't want, if you're one of the Kabila family, for example, or their notably plump followers, you don't want an army that is going to be highly trained and organized and well-drilled. you want an army that is so disorganized that you can play around with it. It will never be a threat either to you or to anybody who happens to invade your country. So that's the calculation that's behind stories like this. Like, they don't make any sense on the surface, but they make sense if you're thinking about a coup in Kinshasa. And that was why, when we get to a certain point in our story tonight, which involves highly motivated allies from Kigali moving into the capital, Kinshasa, they were not welcome. And no one, they were given perfunctory thanks by the Congolese elite for putting them back in power. But they also wanted them out of there as soon as possible, because motivated, organized troops that follow orders, they're dangerous.
Organized, trained, disciplined. These are scary things to certain elites.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's one of those stories that come out of Africa, like, what the hell is going on there? And it doesn't seem to make sense. Like, why would you hire 300 foreigners, who are probably just amateurs anyway, why would you hire them for $5,000 a month? Why can't you just pay your own local people like $3,000 a month and pocket the other $2,000? That would be a fortune for them. And maybe it would make them fight. But yeah, but the calculation of the people running Congo is so cynical that it forces them to think, yeah, maybe it would make them fight you and then forget it. No, no, we'll never do it. We want people from across the world as far as they can get. So this happy land, the Democratic Republic of Congo, is the topic of our show tonight. Specifically, the war in the DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, the big Congo on the right side, the east side or south side of the Congo River, as opposed to Congo Brazzaville, the smaller Congo on the left or north bank of the river. So war in the DRC and M23. There is one way in which this is the biggest war of our era. It's really astonishing that it gets so little attention, but some estimates go to 6 million dead for this. And it's not like there were massive slaughters to account for that many people. There were slaughters, but there's also a very large number of people who can be forced out of their cities by sheer terror. And when you do that and you make them disperse into a tropical rainforest, they die fast, really fast. The benign rainforest ethos is largely fiction. Many, many ways to die when you're hiding in the rainforest, and the children die first. Always the children die first. So this is a big war. It's just not a big war in the sense that it has yielded seemingly heroic battles. There were very, very few heroic battles, because partly because, as we said, the DRC army, well, it's not very clear what its purpose is. It's certainly not to fight, because it doesn't ever fight. It can massacre occasionally, but never fight. So they generally bugged out when people got into town. They bugged out in Goma a couple of weeks ago and stole everything they could on the way out and stuffed it into their vehicles and left.
If you don't mind, I wanted to ask just a couple of basic stats as well. I mean, as you said, it's Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo, formerly known as Zaire, is on, as you said, the southern right side of the Congo River. But Just a couple stats, because I was looking it up. It's about the size of Western Europe, a population of about 100 million. But to give a sense of like how complex its neighborhood is, or, you know, it borders 9 countries, I believe. So here it says borders 9 countries. And that's, there are not a lot of countries that border that many countries in the world. China and Russia and Brazil are, I think, are the only countries that have border more other countries bordering them than the DRC. So there is a lot going on in that area in the middle of Africa. Yeah.
And there are few areas of the world that are popping like that area either. Yeah. So yeah, it's a very big place, very important place. And as far as its importance, we should mention that 70% of the world's coltan is in the eastern DRC, where the M23 is operating. I don't pretend to be a metallurgist, but I read that coltan, quote, coltan is used primarily for the production of tantalum capacitors used in mobile phones and almost every other kind of electronic device. I mean, tantalum capacitors is a science fiction word if I ever heard one. It's like, oh, dilithium crystals. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We have to go down to the planet to get more dilithium crystals because, you know, we can't run the transporters without them. But anyway, apparently coltan is real, and it's found in this area of the eastern DRC where the mountains push up and push up a lot of raw materials that are very valuable right now.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of cobalt there too, which also is for cell phone batteries and a lot of battery technologies. And it's different. I always kind of wondered, is coltan some offshoot of cobalt? But no, they're very different metals or ores. Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing. They both begin with C.
Yes. And then they go, oh.
Yeah. I mean, important.
Listening to the
I'm a trained scholar, see, that's how I can do that stuff.
I literally have a periodic table hanging up in my office here because this is kind of weird, but it really soothes me. I have a giant periodic table up, and it just soothes me.
Yeah, it's weird. It does. I mean, I remember when Lomonov was writing columns for The Exile, and he had one that said, I think I will worship the planet Saturn now. It is a terrible planet. And somehow that comforted me so much. I've thought about it a million times since then. Like, the planet Saturn. Yeah,
I can see.
Anyway, so...
By the way, speaking of that, and I'm sorry, last sidetrack. Have you ever actually looked at Saturn through a powerful telescope? I mean, you know, more powerful than sort of your backyard one. You actually see the ring. It's really cool. There's a planetarium, and, you know, there's the science museum here in Rochester, and with a pretty cool telescope on top of the planetarium. And I brought my older son there, and I was just blown away. You could actually see the ring. And if you have a good telescope, you can see the red spot on Jupiter as well. It's wild. Wow. It's like, oh, it's really there. That wasn't, they weren't tricking us. It's not a Capricorn 1 thing. There really is a ring around that planet. Yeah.
Yeah, I would think that when you have kids in later childhood, especially, you would go to a lot of interesting places that you wouldn't normally bother with.
Yeah. Yeah. Looking at planets is a big one.
Rwanda also exports a lot of these minerals. The export of the minerals has spiked in recent years. And it's not just all on the Rwandan side of the border either. It's all in the mountains. And the mountains are what forms the lakes. This is the lake country. That is sort of the spine of East Africa. And that means that for the next 20 years, I guarantee the New York Times is going to say on a weekly basis, are we losing East Africa to the Chinese?
Yes.
Or the Red Chinese or whatever? Because that gives them a classic Reader's Digest version of frightened patriotism that they can use forever. And by the way, I'm stealing that idea from something I read really long, long ago. It was a Mad Magazine parody of Reader's Digest, and it included a list of fake Reader's Digest stories, and one of them was, are we losing Idaho to the Russians? I've always remembered that one.
Frightened patriotism, yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah. In the course of this war, the larger war in Congo, 7 million and or more people have been displaced. And again, when I say, when you are displaced in this habitat, it's not good. If you're young, you're at tremendous risk, not from lions and tigers and bears, but from mosquitoes and waterborne parasites. Mm-hmm. So the other important basics on this conflict are that Kinshasa, that is a metonymy for the Congo government, accuses Kigali, that is metonymy for the Rwandan government, of funding and supporting M23's resurgence. In return, Kigali, Rwanda, accuses Kinshasa, Congo, of supporting Hutu extremist militias, for example, the FDLR. There are an awful lot of acronyms mm-hmm. in this war, and I may as well warn you about that ahead of time. A lot of acronyms, and there's no use even unpacking them. Just remember, FDLR equals Hutu extremist. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things that I want to say in advance is strange about this conflict. Basically, because the Tutsi get in the way of great power politics. They are not popular people. In fact, they're strikingly unpopular, strikingly hated. And the fact that they went through a genocide makes no difference at all. And the fact that the people who genocided them did not go through anything like a systematic Nuremberg and, in fact, didn't get dissolved at all, but still exist along the borderlands of eastern Congo and western Rwanda does not bother anybody in the Western press. And, in fact, the genocide of the Tutsi in Rwanda in general, I don't think it's led to that many sleepless nights in D.C. or in Paris or in London. I don't think African lives get a lot of respect. And you'll see that in the whole tone of Western reaction to this story. Basically, Rwanda is seen as a real nuisance. And Congo is seen as a rich prize. And Rwanda keeps messing with Congo, the DRC, and that annoys people. The fact that 900,000 Tutsi were hacked to death, mostly with machetes, by their neighbors, has made very few Westerners unhappy for any length of time. I accept some honorable people like Jean Atzfeld, who wrote Rat Roads and other really, really good accounts of the genocide in Rwanda. But there are also many people who have been struggling ever since the genocide to say they brought it on themselves. And unfortunately, a lot of these were European social democrats who decided that the Hutu were the underprivileged and the Tutsi were the I don't know, the feudal elite, which is it's just wrong. Mm. Not a massive oversimplification, I was going to say, but just plain wrong.
And it's also a little creepy because wasn't that the reason why Jews brought it on themselves? Because they were kind of richer than other people or something?
Yeah, or it's overseas Chinese bring it on themselves everywhere in Asia. Yeah. Yeah, people got no imaginations and they're kind of bastards. But anyway, we move along trying to find something to be cheery about. And by the way, we won't, just to spoil the surprise. Okay, let's get to the way the blood splatter got there. The Tutsi, the Hutu, and one other group that we don't need to deal with right now are collectively the Banyarwanda, a language group, culture group in the East African highlands. They, well, if you want to know, it's the Batwa. But anyway, Hutu, Tutsi, Batwa, they all speak Kinyarwanda, the national language of Rwanda. There are other people living there as well, which is typical of Africa in the areas that haven't been ethnically cleansed. There are the Hunde, Nyanga, Nande people. But the Banyarwanda are pretty dominant. They're, for one thing, they're a very dynamic group. They were considered prime colonial material by various 19th century colonists, and they were tinkered with, mostly malignly. And
right, didn't the Belgians ship a bunch of them from Rwanda or Burundi into that eastern part of Zaire as well to work their works?
Yeah, they've been shunted around because they're good fighters, they're good workers. They could in the old days be exploited for imperial ends. They've gotten a little more sophisticated about that now. They've sort of had to. But anyway, I'm trying to find a way to compress all of this so we can get to M23. But in the late 19th century, some Banyarwanda found themselves on the Congolese side, some on the Rwandan border. And as a Radio Warner guest and subscriber Jeremy Rich has said, in the 1920s to 1960s, the Belgians used tax demands to pressure Rwandans from the separate colony of Rwanda to the eastern DRC to work in the mines and plantations. Because, as most people know, I'm sure, the Belgian Congo was an absolute horror story of torment and murder for maximum profit.
Yeah. If I remember right from the book, the Leopold's Ghost book, they estimated the Belgians killed up to 10 million, and I don't know how many people they maimed, chopping off arms as a way to encourage others to keep working in the rubber fields.
It's another one of those African horrors that doesn't get much play in the mainstream media, which is odd.
I think I remember Hillary Clinton, last days of being Secretary of State under Obama, or sometime around then, and she made a tour of Africa, and there were leaders who were talking about still the legacy problems that they deal with. And she publicly said, get over it.
Yeah.
Time to move on. And that is, I think that's the attitude of the West. The West is
and the day they say that to Israel about the Holocaust, by way of maybe taking it a little easy on the Palestinians, that will be the day the world ends.
Yeah.
That's just not going to happen. Because not all dead count equally. That's maybe that's one of the most important messages we can do on Radio Warner. Not all dead count equally. And you can't get away from that. It's sad but true. In the late 1950s, Tutsi fled persecution in Rwanda. moved to Congo. Basically, this is happening, I'm simplifying here, but this is happening in both Burundi, which is a mostly Hutu-controlled state to the north of Rwanda, and in Rwanda, mostly Tutsi-controlled little states astride the mountaintops, which in a tropical area are often the best land to have. Mm-hmm. Remember Mexico City, very, mm-hmm. and, you know, Cusco, both right. high cities in a place that would otherwise be pretty sweltering, very valuable. So they were crossing into Congo, depending on whether the Hutu or the Tutsi had control in either of the countries, Burundi or Rwanda, because there were massacres all along, and massacres that were aided by a lot of European idiots who decided that the Hutu were the working class and then blah, 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 blah. But it was an imposition of European history on Africa that just did not work, but, you know, that didn't stop anybody. Tutsi mostly became half the population of North Kivu, the easternmost province of Congo, but they were still viewed as foreigners by the other groups there, and they were hated as foreigners. There was competition for land, competition for jobs, and the Banyarwanda tended to be very organized people. The whole ethos of Rwanda is very much orderly by the accounts of everyone I've read who's visited there. The atmosphere of the DRC is very different and much more demoralizing. As an example of that, we have what happened to the citizenship status of the Kinyarwanda-speaking groups, the Banyarwanda, of North and South Kivu in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. They were originally under Mobutu accepted as citizens of the DRC. He apparently was influenced by one of his favorites and who was Tutsi, and he said, yeah, okay, we're going to accept these people. We're going to let them in. And then under a new law adopted in 2004, they were stripped of their citizenship, and they were no longer considered Congolese. So it doesn't encourage you to obey the state or respect the state when the state can change its mind about whether you're a citizen or not on a dime like that. So part of this is also related to what's going on with Mobutu. Mobutu, you may remember, if you're old enough, as the frail-looking guy who wore a sort of Nehru-style cap, but in fur, and carried a big stick, and he decided that was the new outfit for Congolese people, even though he kind of made it up. And he was finally forced out, but he did a lot of harm to the country along the way and accumulated a lot of money, like billions of dollars, and died in a Moroccan hospital, I think, probably with the best of care. So meanwhile, in Rwanda, there's constant ethnic violence between Hutu and Tutsi. There had once been a Tutsi monarchy in the 18th century, but that went back and forth a lot of times. There are actually three groups, or there were three groups in the country, the Hutu, the Tutsi, and the Twa. The Twa are better known as the Pygmies, And they were crushed, basically, between the two groups. And some survived, not that many. In the early 1960s, the DRC gets its independence, but it's in the context of the Congo crisis. And the Congo crisis is a complete mess. I mean, a country that's been ruled as badly as the Belgian Congo had been ruled is not going to come out of that wanting to, you know, join the PTA. And the Congo came out of it pretty badly.
That's yeah, it doesn't help that, Lumumba was murdered by basically NATO. I mean, they all, it was like a Godfather thing. But it's up in the air, I guess, whether it was the Belgians or the Belgians' proxies or the CIA. But we know that the CIA, that their poisoner in chief, Sidney Gottlieb, was personally dispatched out to what was Leopoldville with like tubes of poisonous toothpaste and all kinds of different poisons to poison Lumumba, but other people got him and tortured him to death first.
Yeah, that guy is really extraordinary. I mean, you saw a version of that on Get Smart, but you know they, for one thing, they never emphasized the poisons very much because poisons are kind of gross and unfair. But he really seemed to revel in them.
Yeah.
All right, so there are rebellions. They don't usually work against Mobutu. If you want to see a really good description of what happens to a rebellion against Mobutu, you should read A Bend in the River by Naipaul. I know, Mark, that you like that book too.
Yeah, it's great.
Basically, that was when, you know, you could get, I suppose, better white mercenaries, because in that book, you know, the white mercenaries just can't come into town and shoot everybody in the town's elite. And that works. I don't know if that's really what happened, but it's probably not too far off. In 1965, DRC becomes Zaire, part of the whole culture war of Mobutu. And in the 1990s, after Mobutu was flown off to the Moroccan cancer ward, Kagame, of the eventually to be a leading light in the Rwandan Tutsi army, is growing up as a child soldier fighting in Uganda, where his family has fled, one of the many purges in Rwanda. Meanwhile, see, this is where it gets complicated. Yoweri Museveni, you may know his name. He was up against Milton Obote. It was basically one of those civil wars where you just choose your evil. Yoweri Museveni is a terrifying guy in his own right, but he was also outgunned, looked like he was going to lose the war for power in Uganda. He recruited a lot of very, very young Tutsi refugee kids. One of them was Kagame. And to everyone's amazement, they won. They defeated Obote's army. And oddly enough, Yoweri Museveni seemed to have some gratitude for that. It's, you know, a very un-Shakespearean turn of events, but occasionally it happened, I guess. And so they put Yoweri Museveni in the Ugandan presidency. He's still there now, and he helps.
That's amazing that he's still there 40 years on.
He helps when Rwanda needs him, or when his vassal needs him. Because in the 1990s, things get worse in Rwanda. They were not good before then, but this is when things get really bad. The Tutsi are aware of this, and they form, in exile, the Rwandan Patriotic Front. Kagame joins, becomes a commander. But then in 1990, the civil war begins. In fact, it's begun by Kagame's faction, the RPF, because the Hutu majority government of President Juvenal Habyarimana, an ethnic Hutu dictator since 1973, is clearly working toward an extermination plan. The big vehicle for this is Radio Mi Colin, which is like Radio Thousand Hills, which is like a good down-home name for, you know, the Hutu nostalgia slash genocide mood of the country. And they say the Tutsi are cockroaches. They say that every day. In fact, as I wrote long ago, they have an idiot Belgian DJ doing it for them, Georges Rougeau. And he's broadcasting racist murder propaganda full time. The Tutsi know it. They're getting ready for it. Kagame launches a limited offensive into Rwanda, and that just sends the Rwandan leadership into more frenzies of Tutsi hating. They sign an agreement, but it's not going to work very well. People are not happy with the agreement to end the burgeoning civil war within Rwanda. So on April 6, 1994, somebody shoots down Habyarimana's plane as it's coming into land in Kigali. And there are all kinds of, you know, Reichstag fire theories about this, but it's equally possible that he was assassinated because he was a sellout in their terms. He was willing to sign an agreement with the Tutsi rebels because there was quite a lot of hatred by this time. I mean, right. It may not seem like it's such a fraught issue here because, like, most of us probably couldn't tell a Hutu from a Tutsi anyway. I mean, mm-hmm. There are stereotypes. The Tutsi are all tall and they drink so much milk that, you know, the women have nice skin. That was a famous appreciation from the rape squads that were formed during the massacres. But I doubt most of us could tell the difference. But we see this again and again, you know. Mm-hmm. The craziness of small differences being magnified until they are killing issues happens all the time.
John, I'm sure you've come across this because you've written a lot and read a lot about the war and the genocide, the Rwandan war and the genocide. But there's a big contingent of Westerners, at least, and I'm sure they have their counterparts somewhere in Africa, but of Westerners kind of who've done a kind of revisionist version of the genocide, the Rwandan genocide. And a big part of that is blaming Kagame's forces, the RPF, for downing the airplane and deliberately setting off a genocide, knowing that they would be able to use it's sort of working backwards, knowing that the genocide would give them the the opportunity to then take power and control. I come across that actually a lot, and it has a lot of, I don't know, kind of in certain left circles, it has a lot of cash. And I'm sure
left kind of far left psychosis that says, you know, if it looks like A shot B, then it must really be that B shot A. And I'm really not very impressed with that. I sometimes things are either what they seem or just not knowable. And in this case, I don't really know who shot the plane down. As far as I know, it was shot down. It didn't just go down.
Yes. I think everyone agrees on that.
Yeah, but there were an awful lot of people in Rwanda who were eager to start the genocide, and they would have hated the idea of making peace, even temporarily, because they were working nonstop to organize everybody into chopping squads and get them into a war fever, a killing fever. And once you've done that, it's hard to bring people off the boil and then get them mad enough again. Yeah. And so I'm not saying they definitely did it. I'm saying I don't know. I don't think that left faction knows either. Mm-hmm. And just, I mean, look, this goes back to one of the iconic moments of my life. This boyfriend of my flatmate in Berkeley, this mouthy little idiot. We're watching the footage of the Soviet planes flying into Afghanistan, and he looks at me looking at it and says, "Don't believe everything you hear, kid." Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there's such an obvious explanation for why it was Hutu extremists who did this after the peace deal accords were signed. Like, the motivations were obvious. They had control of the country. They were ready to go. So, like, you know, like you said, we weren't there. We don't know. And it's just this kind of revisionism that's going around. A revisionism that, I mean, it's not just of a corner of the left. I mean, it really, there are larger interests that would like to see it that way as well.
That's definitely true.
Yeah.
That's definitely true. There is a surprising, I hinted at this before, but maybe I should say it clearly. There is a surprisingly pervasive hatred of the Tutsi in the media and the NGO world in general. And it just creeps me the fuck out. Mm-hmm. I just don't know what to do about it. It's strange. It's as if, unless you make people pay attention and pay their respects to massacres, they tend to despise the victims. You have to work really hard to avoid that consensus. And in this case, nobody much cared about the Tutsi. Samantha Power supposedly had an epiphany, like, we must not let this happen ever again. Mm-hmm. I don't think it took, you know? I don't think she really got it all that much.
No, she just was able to use that tragedy basically as an example to use in order to shame people into supporting a really bad intervention somewhere else. That's it. Like
Yugoslavia, for example.
Yeah, Yugoslavia and Libya. You know, that power was more part of power when we did the really catastrophic Libya intervention that everyone just walked away from, and it's still, that country's still broken. And then just conveniently completely forgotten, during the whole Gaza genocide. So it never meant anything to her, even though she wrote a book about it. It was just for the cocktail circuit or something.
So this is when the one event in Rwandan history that, well, most people know about. I wouldn't even bet that everybody knows about it, but I would bet that most people know about it. April 1994 begins the Rwandan genocide. It's set off by Habyarimana's assassination. And, you know, by the way, it just occurred to me, which is more plausible? The Hutu military that controls the ground of the airport and patrols it is likely to have a heavy weapon in place ready to down that plane when it's attempting to land, or a bunch of Tutsi little super spies have infiltrated the airport and brought in some kind of heavy weapon that can do it. I mean, it's crazy. Yeah. But anyway, so they say, do it now. You know, get your machetes, kill the cockroaches, and everyone obeys. It's a very, very organized society, and people do what they're told. In many cases, there are civic leaders, priests, nuns, who lead the genocide. Not everybody, there are exceptions, again, but most of them go along with what they're expected to do. And they almost do it as, you know, a chore, although they take time out to rape and loot in the process. The only reason that stopped, and it's really important for people to notice this, it does not stop because there's some UN intervention. There is no UN intervention. There is no United States intervention. There is no NATO intervention. The RPF, the Tutsi guerrilla group, went in and fought the Hutu-controlled army, beat them easily, and took control of the country. And that's why the genocide stopped. Mm-hmm. So the entire administration of Rwanda changes. A lot of people expected a bloodbath or a counter-bloodbath. That didn't happen, which is pretty amazing in itself. I have to say, if I was a Rwandan Tutsi and my whole family had been exterminated as part of some imbecilic racial doctrine, I don't know that I would have been as civilized as that. But this is a people that, you know, are very orderly, and that's both good and bad, depending on what you're telling them to do, like, you know, be friends again or take up the machete. Paul Kagame, the guerrilla leader who was a large part of the military offensive that actually stopped the genocide, became Minister of Defense and Vice President. But 2 million Hutu refugees, expecting that there would be a mass reprisal, you know, their leaders perhaps judging others by themselves, as we might say, led, sometimes by force, their followers across that porous border between Congo and Rwanda again, into North and South Kivu provinces, which are the Congolese side of the mountain provinces, the ones where you see the mountain gorillas, the ones where you find cities like Goma amidst exploding volcanic cones.
Yeah, they're incredibly beautiful. I mean, when you see them.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. Stunning. Yeah, I don't think there's much hope for the mountain gorillas, but, you know, still a lot of nice country up there. And there are Tutsi militias organizing against the Hutu militias because, you know, they've just killed everybody of your ethnicity inside their own country, and now they're moving over here across the border, and this government already decided we're not citizens. Who do you depend on? The only thing you can do is organize among yourselves. And so the Tutsi start organizing within the eastern provinces of Congo. The Hutu counter-organize. Something very, very typical that I don't think people understand about war often enough is when a group is defeated and it becomes the lord of nothing but a miserable POW camp, they don't usually lose heart.
Yeah.
They just police that miserable POW camp as if it were their whole country. And they double down on whatever terror control they have over the people inside it. Yeah. So the Hutu camps become scary places. There are a lot of sallies leading out of them against other people. There are Hutu-Tutsi battles, Hutu battles against other ethnic groups in the area, Tutsi battles against other ethnic groups. It is briefly chaos. And the Congo government, where are they? And you know, there's an anecdote about Che Guevara visiting Africa, and he's very impressed with certain countries. When he gets to Congo, he meets the older Kabila, I think, he's been around a long time, and he stayed around a long time. And to Guevara's utter shock, Kabila only wants to talk about the nightclubs of Paris and the dancing girls of Paris and the champagne and all that. And there's some famous quote from Guevara like, forget about these people. The Congolese elite is totally spoiled. So the Congolese elite really doesn't much care about what happens in its far-flung provinces, like at all. But this province happens to have important raw materials. So they're kind of concerned about it. And most of all, their American CIA sponsors are saying, you know, you got to put a cap on this, because the Congolese elite may have gotten rid of Mobutu, but as far as I know, they haven't changed very much. Mm-hmm. They may have rebelled against Mobutu, but they did so mainly in order to take power themselves. So they don't really care about this. Kabila is put in power, however, by one of the most extraordinary military adventures in the last century, I would say. In 1996, the whole situation explodes. And you have to imagine it's all downhill from the mountain areas where the Rwanda war has been fought. It is literally downhill into the Congo Basin, but it's also metaphorically downhill, because the government of Mobutu is very, very weak, even weaker than it was 20 years ago. I mean, it's completely corrupt. It's given up completely on the development of the country and has devoted himself entirely to ruling his own little fiefdom and indulging in the quarrels within his clan and amassing large amounts of graft. And the people who have now seized power in the Lake Country in the east realize, with the collusion of Laurent Désiré Kabila, guerrilla leader, if you want to call him that, in Congo, that they can seize power. So they begin marching west. And the Congolese army is in no shape to oppose them at any stage. And they perform this epic march. And it ends up with Mobutu fleeing, ending his life, as I recall, in a Moroccan hospital.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. And the coalition installs their own Congolese, well, puppet, really, Laurent Désiré Kabila. And he instantly turns on them and denies the claim that Rwanda was responsible for winning the war, denies that they were the ones who put him in power, because, of course, his Congolese voters are going to resent him for that. So he just says, no, had nothing to do with them. It was just me. He removes all the Tutsis from his government, takes a lot of measures to weaken Rwanda's military presence in the eastern part of Congo. And in short, it's very Shakespearean, by the way, betrays, absolutely betrays the best friends he ever had. He orders finally all foreign troops out of the Congo, and most bitter blow of all, he helps Hutu armed groups to organize at the border once again. And this sets the stage with, you know, enough rancor that you could replace the entire Atlantic Ocean with digestive juices. And it will last for a long time, and it will fuel what we have to say about the remainder of the story in the next RWN.
Mm-hmm. Good. Okay, so let's stop here, leaving off right on the eve of what would be the second and really bloody Congo War.
Yeah.
And that's going to go right into M23. Okay, that was really great. Thanks, John.
I mean, I probably spent a long time leading up here, but, you know, this is Radio War Nerd. We don't we don't do the 10-minute survey thing, damn it.
No. No, this is great. And it's long overdue. So I think it's fine to spend extra time on this because it is long overdue, I think, from a lot of our subscribers asking for this. So good. I think we can end it here. Thank you again, John Brendan, and thank you to all of our subscribers. And talk to you again soon, and we'll get on to part two.
Okay, thanks, everybody. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.